Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities with Public Schools Unite Us initiative, and United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org. A federal court has temporarily blocked the Trump administration's efforts to pause operations at Job Corps centers nationwide, including 7 contractor-operated centers across New York State. Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar has more.
The U.S. District Court for New York Southern District temporarily blocked the Trump administration's effort to suspend Job Corps centers that would have included 7 centers across New York State, including the Delaware Valley Job Corps Center in Calicoon. Last week, the U.S. Labor Department announced it would pause operations at 99 Job Corps centers by the end of June as part of Trump's efforts to shrink the federal workforce. A U.S. district judge has since issued a temporary restraining order and preliminary injunction against any efforts to eliminate the Job Corps program without congressional authorization. New York District 19 Representative Josh Riley wrote in a social media post he was glad the court stepped in, adding that Job Corps is a lifeline for young people in upstate New York. Job Corps is the largest free residential education and job training program for young adults ages 16 to 24 in the U.S. Here's Laura Quigley, Commissioner for Sullivan County Division of Community Services, at a county legislature meeting sharing how the cuts have already impacted Job Corps students and workers who thought the centers were closing.
Students have already left. They've been leaving in small groups because they were told they needed to be out by the 12th. There will be roughly about 20 students left that are homeless or are in a position where they cannot go back home. And those are the people that we're going to directly link up with Orange County and New York City.
Quigley says this has disrupted student and worker livelihoods, and that if the government wants to eliminate this program, it has to be done in an orderly manner.
You can't close this down in 30 days. It just doesn't happen that way. So I'm very glad for the restraining order. We'll see what happens.
The federal court ordered the Department of Labor to appear at a court hearing on June 17th. In Liberty, I'm Kimberly Izar for the New York Public News Network.
Farmers' markets across the state and nation have either lost or had their federal grant funding put on hold. To that end, Schenectady County Regional Farmers Market recently held a community forum to discuss its uncertain future. The Legislative Gazette's Jesse Taylor reports.
In addition to operating a farmers' market, the Schenectady Green Market provides food accessibility services to residents of the county. One of its flagship services is its food box program. The Green Market purchases about $25 to $30 worth of food from its vendors, packages 6 to 7 items in a box, and delivers the food for just $10 a box. Any family can sign up for the program, but priority is given to those with lower incomes. It currently serves roughly 30 families a week. Amira Singletary is a 50-year-old mother who benefits from the service.
That's for nothing. They're not just a food market. They're a little bit of sunshine in your day. Because when, like, I had 2 total knee replacements. I couldn't go outside for months. They delivered food to my house. Not only did they deliver food to my house, but they delivered food with love.
Now, a pause in federal funding has placed a gray cloud over what Schenectady Green Market's food box program and other services may look like in the future. Cheryl Wilby is the Green Market's Executive Director of Development and Finance. Wilby says the organization was awarded a 3-year, $250,000 grant by the USDA in September that the market had been hoping to use to expand services, such as adding 10 more families to its food box program, creating a vendor success toolkit to assist the market's vendors, and increasing the market's capacity. Wilby says the federal government under the Trump administration paused the grant funds in January.
What comes up for me in terms of the loss here is the loss of sustainability. Being able to have 3 years of guaranteed funding means that we can think more deeply about what expansion can look like for our work.
Vice Chair of the Markets Board, Chris Longo, says as a result of the funding pause, the organization had to walk back many of the new projects it had planned.
The new things to give our underrepresented vendors a chance to move up in this world, a chance to make their money with their own two hands, gone.
Longo says the organization was planning to use the funding to hire a translator to help non-native English-speaking vendors fill out the Green Market's application and grant applications.
We're a good market. We're well attended. We're profitable. But we're underrepresenting people in our own community because they can't fill out a form. And we just wanted to have the funding to bring on somebody who speaks a second language, who can help these folks. And that's what this money was going for.
Although the market has had to pause some of its expansion and implementation of new programs because of the federal grant pause, Wilby says the organization is still looking for ways to improve.
We need to take the time to step back and hear from community about what they want to see, and that helps us drive our mission forward in a way that's in alignment with what the community desires.
Singletary, the mother who relies on the food box program, said she was devastated when she found out the federal funds had been cut.
To hear that they're not getting what they need means that I'm not going to be able to get what I need.
The Schenectady Green Market can be found on J Street every Sunday from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. during warmer seasons and inside Proctor's during the winter. In Schenectady, I'm Jesse Taylor.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. This week, I sat down with Corinne Carey, Senior Campaign Director for Compassion and Choices for New York and New Jersey. She's been working on educating lawmakers for 10 years with the hope of passing a medical aid in dying law in New York. And this year may just be the year it passes.
The legislation models Oregon's first law ever in this country that was passed in 1994. And very simply, medical aid in dying allows a terminally ill person to request from their doctor a prescription for medication that they can take at a time of their choosing, so long as they can self-ingest that medication and die peacefully. The illness that someone has to be incurable and irreversible, not because if someone can't afford the treatment or if someone can't access it, literally incurable and irreversible, even if they had the means to cure it.
Yeah, it's not 50% chance, not 60%, totally incurable.
Absolutely. And the person has to be given a prognosis of 6 months or less. There needs to be an attending physician to whom the person makes an oral request and a written request. And then a consulting physician, both of those physicians have to agree that the person has mental capacity, has a terminal illness, and has a six-month prognosis.
So it's like a first and second opinion.
It's true. And both of them have to do a mental health screening. And if either doctor has concerns about that person's mental health capacity, they have to refer that person to a mental health professional. And no prescription can be written unless and until that professional signs off on the mental capacity.
Those are high bars. I mean, you know, because you can imagine that someone knowing they're going to die are going to have a little bit of a mental health problem to begin with and wrestling with that. So, you know, you've got to really work with the person to figure out where they are.
Absolutely. And there's a big difference between clinical depression that can be treated
right. And
situational depression.
Yeah.
And it is the doctor's role to determine whether that depression rises to the level where it clouds the person's judgment and is interfering with their ability to make a fully informed decision.
Yeah. So then they have to self-administer, which takes the worry about a greedy son-in-law, you know, wants to get rid of his mother-in-law to get an inheritance or something. Right?
Sooner than
yeah.
they might.
Yeah.
I mean, the fact is these folks are dying,
yep.
and that's what I think people need to remember. I also want to dispel, you know, kind of a myth that people think it's a pill. It's not. It's a medication protocol. And that protocol is more of an assurance that the person is acting of their own free will, because they have to take preparatory medication 45 minutes to an hour before they take the final medication. And at any point in the process, the person can change their minds. I think that's a really important piece of this bill.
Are they asked if they want to change their mind, or it's just up to them to say that?
It's up to them. I mean, once the doctor goes through all of the steps of approving someone, then it's in the patient's hands. And anything else would pressure the patient to act on a timetable that may not be their own. And that's another important thing to understand is that, look, when we send people home on hospice care, there's no continual monitoring of that. You know, we send them home with a pack of medication that they can take to relieve their suffering. And they're trusted, and their families are trusted to know how to administer that medication. It's important to trust dying people and their families to take care of one another. And that's a key part of this bill as well.
Where's Governor Kathy Hochul on this?
The governor has not made a public statement about this bill. She has repeatedly said that she will wait to see when the legislature delivers her the bill. And I've worked with the governor in the past. We worked on the women's equality agenda.
Mm-hmm.
Was that several decades ago? Feels like
a while ago now.
And I feel like her heart will be there. I think she understands the suffering that people have to endure at the end of life. And I think that she listens to trusted doctors who have experience in this area. And we certainly hope that she's listening to the voices of the many, many terminally ill people and their family members across the state who are calling on her to support and sign this bill.
Corinne Carey, are you, when you make the arguments in New York, are you bringing in folks from the other states that have it to say, hey, it's working in our state?
Somewhat. I mean, I find that us New Yorkers, we
don't care.
Well, there's a certain degree of exceptionalism here.
Yeah.
And I'm a little guilty of that myself. But what we do have in New York is we've had families whose loved ones have used medical aid in dying in other states.
Yeah.
And now we have a New Yorker whose loved one has used the law in every single state where medical aid in dying is legal. And they have come to the Capitol to testify. They've shared their stories with newspapers and with lawmakers. And it's tremendously effective for lawmakers to hear firsthand from a family member how this works. The other advantage we have is that the New York State Bar Association did a deep dive into medical aid in dying. They convened a task force, and they invited experts from across the country.
Great.
On both sides of this issue, opponents and supporters, and unanimously that task force recommended that New York should pass the Medical Aid in Dying Act, and then the full House of Delegates of the Bar Association followed.
That was a really important discussion to have both audiences in the room to work that out.
Absolutely. The League of Women Voters did the same thing. They held forums across the state for over a year to determine what their position would be.
So I can feel the tension in the air, right? You're just waiting. You're hoping beyond all hope that this comes through. If there's one single argument that's been the biggest block to this legislation, what is it?
I think it is the feeling that the state shouldn't, I don't know, maybe give up on improving hospice and palliative care. And New York ranks absolute last among all states in terms of appropriate access to hospice and palliative care.
Well, there's that exceptionalism right there.
Yeah, and so, you know, there are lawmakers who say, why don't we put all of our energy into improving hospice and palliative care? And what has become so clear to us in advocating for expanded end-of-life choices across the country is that hospice and palliative care and access to those services actually improves when you pass a medical aid in dying law. So if we want to make end-of-life care better for everyone, no matter what choice they want to make at the end of their lives, we need to open up this conversation. We need to allow physicians and their patients to have open and honest conversations about what dying people fear the most at the end of their lives. And doctors will refer people for hospice and palliative care. It's required under the bill. And doctors want to see those services work for people. And so if we want to improve that, let's pass this option. Let's open up the conversation and make sure that we're addressing everyone's needs at the end of life.
Seems to me, if we're an exceptional state, we want all options on the table. We certainly want to vet them. We want to make sure that they're safe and that they work. But we should be expanding and improving palliative care. We should be providing options for end of life. We should be doing all of it.
Right. And we shouldn't be having to look over the border in New Jersey and Vermont and now Delaware, look to California and say they're doing it better than we are. Why would we want that?
That's Corinne Carey, Senior Campaign Director for Compassion and Choices for New York and New Jersey. Listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. With its last graduation in Western Massachusetts in the rearview mirror, Bard College at Simon's Rock is preparing to relocate from Great Barrington to the Hudson Valley this fall. The Legislative Gazette's Jesse King reports.
Bard College at Simon's Rock, which allows high school students to start college as early as 10th grade, announced last year that it would be moving to a recently acquired facility next to the main Bard campus in fall 2025. Bard Academy, its pre-college program for 8th and 9th graders, will also be moving to Annandale on Hudson. For physics professor Michael Bergman, it's a move that comes with mixed emotions. He is one of a handful of faculty members to get a job on the new campus. He's worked for Simon's Rock for more than 30 years, and he will continue to do so with an hour commute from his home in Great Barrington. Bergman says he's got friends teaching on the main Bard campus, but he'll miss his colleagues back home.
Obviously, I'm not thrilled about the commute, and I felt like we had built a pretty good program here, and now it's starting over in some sense. So that's difficult, but I guess it's exciting to see if we can get it off the ground.
Bard Academy in Simon's Rock says it is keeping just 40 of its roughly 140 faculty and staff in the move as it seeks to downsize and consolidate its operations into the main Bard campus. Some staff will continue to work on the Great Barrington campus to help with the transition through 2025. Harrison Levenstein, a ceramics assistant, artist in residence, and adjunct professor at Simon's Rock, says his contract expires at the end of June. His position no longer exists at the new campus.
On one hand, it didn't seem like a huge surprise. And on the other hand, it felt like a huge punch in the gut.
John Weinstein, provost and vice president at Simon's Rock, says declining enrollment was a deciding factor in the move. Last year, the program had just 280 students. And like a lot of smaller colleges nationwide, Weinstein says Simon's Rock was faced with a choice, merge more into Bard or fold.
We were really starting to look at what might be a long-term plan for the next 50 years, and being a freestanding campus of a few hundred students just wasn't really going to kind of work out from an economic standpoint.
So far, he says most of the remaining students are making the jump to Annandale on Hudson, more so than they expected. He predicts a class of more than 200 students next year. Over time, Weinstein hopes the higher population of the Hudson Valley will bring those numbers up.
I certainly will encourage Hudson Valley families to get to know us, because even though we do draw from across the country and across the world, there is a day student option as well that might interest people.
Construction is underway to get Bard's Messina campus ready for the fall. The college bought Messina, a former seminary, in 2023. Weinstein says the 260-acre location will maintain a separate feel from Bard, despite its proximity to the main campus. 8th and 9th graders at Bard Academy will be housed separately from the older students at the main Messina Mansion overlooking the Hudson River.
That will be specifically their space. The early college students in their first year will be on one floor of the seminary building, and then they'll be living in early college-specific housing in their second year, but that will be located on the main campus, while yet distinct. So at each stage, there's a little more closeness and more opportunities, but it also enables us to really provide a different environment for the students on the youngest age of the spectrum.
As students progress more in their college studies, Weinstein says they will take more and more classes at the main Bard campus and have the opportunity to join Bard clubs, musical groups, and sports teams. Bergman says he's especially excited to see his students again in the new location. As for Levenstein, he's not going to the Hudson Valley, but his work at Simon's Rock prompted a love for Western Massachusetts. After working in the area for 5 years, he's decided to stay and is preparing to open a community ceramic studio in Great Barrington. He hopes to encourage the environment he saw in his Simon's Rock classes. He says the moving of the campus is a loss for Great Barrington and a gain for the Hudson Valley.
It was such a unique community, but it really felt small. And the way people are on that campus are just, it's, everyone is so sensitive and kind, and the way the students support each other is always just so amazing to me. It's so different than like the kind of high school age experience of school that I had.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Jesse King.
Officials and residents recently celebrated the completion of a number of state-funded development projects in Gloversville, as the Legislative Gazette's Aaron Schella-Levine reports.
St. Thomas Square in Gloversville wasn't exactly the most scenic site for a farmer's market, but a new vendor space and newly planted grass and trees have given fresh life to the once barren parking lot, transforming the square in the heart of the city into a welcoming space for residents and market vendors. The St. Thomas Square overhaul is one of five recently completed or soon-to-be-completed projects to come out of Gloversville's $10 million State Downtown Revitalization Initiative funds, awarded in 2021. Gloversville Mayor Vincent DeSantis says the DRI initiatives have made a tangible difference throughout the Mohawk Valley City, with St. Thomas Square serving as a prime showcase.
The farmers market is active for 4 hours a week in the summer on Saturday morning, but there was no activity around it. It was the DRI that gave us the incentive and gave us the wherewithal to be able to expand that project, including a new building, to an active space.
DeSantis sees the completion of these projects as a part of his legacy. After more than four decades of public service in the city, he's not seeking re-election. The lifelong resident hopes this is the beginning of the next era for the Fulton County City, once the hub of the country's glove manufacturing.
So we're celebrating here today not just the first physical manifestation in bricks and mortar of the downtown, but also the first manifestations of the city's rebirth.
New York Secretary of State Walter Mosley was on hand to help unveil the finished projects.
Gloversville, you can clearly see that you have the right civic leader and civic leaders in your council members, and the enthusiasm of the community members, which is really reflective in this room. And that's evident by the remarkable speed by which you completed these four projects, as well as the quality of these projects you have chosen. You have set the bar high, and I don't say that often, not to say that the other DRI recipients haven't, but this has taken it to a new level.
In addition to the $1.1 million put toward the renovation of St. Thomas Square, the city says an initial $1.2 million in DRI funds has turned into $22 million in private investments in the form of the soon-to-be-completed Glove City Apartments. The 75 mixed-income units across the street from City Hall are expected to go on the market in September. In addition, DRI funding also allowed the city to complete a $346,000 renovation of the Shine Memorial Hall, as well as a nearly $500,000 expansion of the city's Trail Station Park. Meanwhile, $435,000 in DRI funds have turned a formerly vacant lot on Main Street into a piazza. Mayor DeSantis envisions outdoor music shows and movie viewings in the space. While last week's announcement celebrated the newly rebuilt downtown, a fire in April threatened the city's urban core. No one was hurt, but flames destroyed the historic Founds Glove Factory, an apartment building, and a neighboring exotic pet store. Now, the cleanup from that fire may even help spur development, allowing for new construction at the Founds site instead of a more involved restoration, DeSantis says.
After the fire, we are hoping to get grant funding to clean up the area and to make it available for new construction. New construction is a much lighter lift than restoring a historic building. So the opportunity is still there for activating South Main Street at that space.
It all adds up to a reimagined downtown that's encouraging longtime residents. Gloversville native Valerie Levine said she's excited to bring her grandkids to Gloversville's reimagined downtown.
I just love it because downtown, or Gloversville downtown, was a wonderful, wonderful place to grow up. And then it took a downturn because of the leather industry leaving our area, and things became really down in the mouth all the way around. Still some nice areas, things like that. But putting in the rail station park and the splash pad and this St. Thomas Square, and we have the bike path, and it just makes me feel more prouder of the area, and that gives me a great feeling that I can feel that way about Gloversville again.
Reporting on the campus of Skidmore College, I'm Aaron Shello Levine.
That about does it for this week's show. The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. We had help from the New York Public News Network. You can listen anytime at wamcpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcast. Look for program number 2523. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York state government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina. Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.